Good morning, Oregon. Thank you once again for loading me down and queuing me up. I'm Finn J.D. John, bringing you another daily episode of the Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. Every weekday, this podcast brings you another story from the archives of the Offbeat Oregon History syndicated newspaper column. For the full details of that, please check out offbeatoregon.com when you get a chance. But first of all, today I'd like you to sit back and relax and let me tell you the story of how the Holy Roller cult ended up. The Bride of Christ Church cult in Corvallis, Oregon, and later in Waldport, Oregon. This organization sought perfect righteousness, Christ-like simplicity, total humility. In practice, though, it didn't work out that way. It spawned nothing but misery and madness, and also a legal precedent in Washington Territory for honor killings. A legal precedent that, of course, doesn't still stand. But it was established. This story first published in the newspapers on June 5th, 2011. Remember, this is part two of a two-story series. Last week, we talked about how this cult started. F. Edmund Craffield, the preacher from the Salvation Army, for whom the Salvation Army was not sufficiently holy, established his own outfit. We've reached the point at which he's been tarred and feathered and run out of town and finally prosecuted for adultery, and he is just about to get out of prison on that charge. Here we go. In the autumn of 1904, F. Edmund Craffield, the F stands for France, by the way, was sentenced to 2 years in prison. As a practical matter, though, the sentence might as well have been death. When Craffield emerged from prison after serving his term, it was a completely different world that waited for him outside. And by different, I do not mean better. Craffield, founder of the most hardcore holy roller church in history, as far as I know, had been convicted of adultery for having sex with one of his female followers, 23-year-old Donna Mitchell Starr. He told the court it was part of a God-ordered purification ritual. It still isn't known for sure if he thus purified any of the other women in his cult, but everyone outside his secretive little group instantly assumed he had. By the time the adultery charge was made, nearly all of the men had left the Bride of Christ Church, leaving only Craffield and one other man as leaders of a flock of pretty much exclusively women. Women who, following Craffield's instructions, had cut off all relations with their infidel husbands and friends and children. And now they were locked away from their loved ones, out of the community's sight, having placed themselves under the authority of a man who, as it now appeared, saw nothing wrong with adultery. And remember, the cult was rumored to believe in staying naked all the time. This rumor almost certainly was groundless and was based on the perceived inadequacy by Edwardian-era standards of the, quote, simple garment that believers wore. But people believed it, and it was definitely a factor. To outsiders, Craffield's flock was looking more and more like a harem, and less like a congregation. The husbands of women in Craffield's flock now started considering themselves not just cut off from marital and other relations, but cuckolded to boot. Older brothers assumed that their little sisters had been sexually initiated. Men, at least three, probably more, started buying guns and making plans to use them. The first attempt on Craffield's life happened in Yaquina City, near Newport. Craffield had returned to Corvallis just long enough to collect his scattered flock back together and lead them out of town. As had Moses so many years before, he was going to lead his people into the wilderness, a patch of unimproved woodland near Waldport on the coast. God would take care of them there. Among the women in Craffield's flock at the time he went to prison were Cora Hartley and her daughter Sophia. When Craffield was locked away, the two of them came home to Cora's husband, Lewis Hartley, with whom they'd had nothing to do after joining the church. He was, after all, an unbeliever, and believers were not supposed to consort with the damned. Lewis was obviously not happy when Craffield, fresh from the slammer, strolled into town and called for his former flock to come follow him into the wilderness. Cora and Sophia answered the call immediately and started getting ready to go. When the two of them left town on T. Edgington Hogg's railroad line to Yaquina City and Newport to join their prophet by the sea, Lewis secretively followed. When he arrived in Yaquina City, Lewis realized he'd lost their trail. The two women had spotted him en route and gotten off early at Toledo to shake him. So he hopped a ferry to Newport and tried to find a judge who would order Creffield's arrest. None would. So Hartley went to a sporting goods store instead, and with a brand new .32 caliber revolver in his pocket, Hartley now started searching not for his family, but for Creffield. Eventually, not finding his quarry in Newport, Hartley boarded the ferry and returned to Yaquina City. Yaquina City, by the way, there's no trace of it anymore. It's a ghost town that's not even a ghost anymore. And at this time, it was the terminus of that railroad line. Back to our story. As the vessel was docking, Hartley saw his wife and daughter on the stern of the departing ferry. There were two ferries, one arriving and one departing. Creffield was with them. Hartley leaped from his ferry and raced to the other ferry just as it pulled away from the slip. He drew his revolver and opened fire on Creffield, who stood on the ferry facing him a few yards away. Five clicks rang out. The bullets Hartley had bought with the pistol were the wrong type for the gun. He'd loaded this rimfire pistol with centerfire ammo. Although he put a good face on it at the time, Creffield seems to have taken this lesson to heart. From then on, he was a hard man to find, always on the move. He led his flock to the wilderness camp, but didn't stay long. When Hartley returned with a Winchester rifle to try again, he found his prey long gone. Over the following few months, Creffield's itinerant lifestyle frustrated at least one other would-be assassin, and probably more. But eventually, Creffield ended up in Seattle, and it was in that city, at 7:10 a.m. on May 7th, 1906, as he was walking down the street with Maud, that a fellow named George Mitchell walked up behind him with a pocket pistol and casually put a bullet into the back of his head. Mitchell was the brother of two of Creffield's most devoted followers, Esther Mitchell and Donna Mitchell Starr. The latter, you might remember, was the woman he was convicted of adulterously purifying. Mitchell, after the police arrived, quietly handed over his pistol. Quote, "I have only done my duty," he told the officers, according to police reports. "I came here to kill that man, as he ruined my two sisters, and I have completed my work." The trial was something of a landmark for Seattle. There was widespread sympathy for Mitchell. For all practical purposes, his defense rested on something known as the unwritten law, the one that says it's okay for a man to perpetrate what you might call an honor killing on the fellow who's defiled his wife or sister. When the trial concluded, the jury found Mitchell not guilty. This in spite of the fact that he had admitted in open court to an action that fit the definition of premeditated murder with remarkable precision. Although the smart money had been on a not guilty by reason of insanity verdict, the word when it came up was just plain not guilty. Mitchell was a free man. He wouldn't even have to spend a week in the insane asylum on the way out. In finding this way, without invoking an insanity defense that would result in Mitchell spending some time in an asylum, the members of the jury no doubt thought they were doing him a favor. They were gravely mistaken. A few days later, Mitchell met up with his sister Esther in a railroad depot for what other family members hoped would be a reconciliation of sorts. Instead, it turned into another execution. Esther shot her older brother in the back of the head with a pocket pistol in almost exactly the same way he had gunned down Creffield. In the aftermath of this shocker, the newspaper reporters really wanted Esther to tell them that God had told her to avenge Creffield's death, or that somehow a religious frenzy had made her do it. Instead, she told them two things. First, she said, she was doing exactly what her brother had done. The law was inadequate to the task of punishing a murderer, as evidenced by the fact that he'd been acquitted despite having admitted in court that he did it. This was pretty similar to George's claim that he'd had to shoot Creffield because the law wouldn't keep him away from his sisters. Secondly, she pointed out that George had done exactly what he'd accused Creffield of doing, branded her as a fornicator. She insisted that Creffield had never had sex with her by making the statement that he had killed Creffield because he'd ruined his sisters. George had, in effect, ruined his sisters. At her trial, Esther Mitchell refused to try to claim insanity. The state forced it on her anyway and committed her to an asylum. A few years later, out of the asylum and staying at a family friend's place, she took a massive dose of strychnine and died, following the example of the widowed Claude Hurt Creffield, who'd killed herself in the same manner shortly after the trial. I think this qualifies as a story with no winners. Even water in excessive quantities is a deadly poison. Perhaps the same is true of what Creffield and his faithful followers would call the water of life. That's it for today's train wreck of an episode. And if you're listening for the first time and would like some more information about Offbeat Oregon history, you can get all the information at our central website at offbeatoregon.com. The website's also where you'll find full citations to sources for this story, which include books by Jim Phillips and Rosemary Gartner, Stuart Holbrook, and Lewis Thompson. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band, atlasstringband.com, and it was written by Carmen Ficarra. This podcast is covered under a Creative Commons license. For details of that, see offbeatoregon.com/cc. Coming to Corvallis, do drop me a line. Let's grab a cup of coffee and talk history. I'm at finn@offbeatoregon.com, or you can catch me on Twitter @offbeatoregon. That's it for today. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to talk about the persistent and fairly well-founded rumors that Sir Francis Drake's Nova Albion that he discovered back in the 1500s, well, it might not have been the San Francisco Bay where everybody seems to think it is. There is some reason to believe that Nova Albion was actually Whale Cove on the Central Oregon coast. Whether that is true or not, we probably never will really know. But I have the details of what we do know after about 6 a.m. tomorrow morning. That would be Tuesday. So in the meantime, go fill up the rest of today with good stuff. Bye now.